So, we are recording this talk, recording it for the Mountain Rain website on one machine, and on another machine, recording it for the Everyday Zen website. I've been traveling, and I just got back home the other day before coming up here, and I gave a talk for my Dharma seminar, and I was out of my routine, so I forgot to bring my recorder to record my seminar Dharma talk, the first seminar in a series. So that's why I'm recording this talk again, I mean, for the first time, giving that talk today. So this is how we are in multiple universes at multiple times and places forever. But I think that I'm in Vancouver. Do you think you're in Vancouver also?
No.
Yeah, no, she doesn't. Kui doesn't think so, yeah. She's probably right. I think I'm in Vancouver, and I think that I haven't been here in a while, and I'm happy to be here. It's really nice to see everybody. I always have a very funny experience when I come back to places that I come to regularly, as I've been coming here for so many years. I always feel like I never left. As soon as I walk in, it's like this is the same moment that I am resuming from the last time I was here, as if there were no intervening time at all. And I pick up my warm friendship with all of you exactly as if there's no intervening time at all. Mm-hmm. It's a very odd life that I'm living. However, you're living the same life too. It's odd. So we were gone, and my wife Kathy and I, who's now retired and now can travel with me sometimes, we were in Korea for about a month, and then we came home from Korea and we went to Upaya Zen Center in Santa Fe, where we did a short practice period, and Batya was there. Yeah. When we were in Korea, we were on a Dharma mission to freshen up and open up the great Chogye order of Korean Buddhism, which is the largest Buddhist order in Korea, essentially Seon Buddhism or Zen Buddhism, Rinzai Zen Buddhism. And this mission was not our mission. It was the mission of our friends in Korea who brought us to Korea, people in the Chogye order, who passionately are hoping for more openness and more relevance in their Buddhism. And it was their thought that if they brought an American Zen Buddhist priest in good standing to Korea, and that American priest were simply to talk about our practice in the West, that people in Korea would listen to this, and they would hear it. It would be more impressive to them than just the people in Korea saying the same, pretty much the same things. This is our world, right? The crazy world. So that's why they brought us to Korea. And it took about many years to plan and figure out this trip, and it was quite the trip. I was really impressed with it and surprised. We arrived, and the very next day we had a giant press conference. Can you believe a press conference with all these journalists and TV cameras and photographers? It was quite something. We went all over the country giving talks, giving retreats, some big public talks. Wherever we went, there were TV cameras. There's a Buddhist television network in Korea, and they filmed every single talk, every single moment of the trip. And our journey happened to coincide with the impeachment trial that was going on for their president. And they had been in the streets every Saturday for 6-8 months or more calling. About 80%, they told me, of the population was calling for the impeachment of this corrupt president. So we were there right in the middle of this, right when it came to a head, actually. So in the press conferences, there were lots of questions about what's the relevance of Dharma? Is there a way to practice compassionate politics with our Dharma practice? Is there a way to care about the world and help the world? Could the practice actually help us? Or is, as perhaps traditionally they have thought in Korea, enlightenment somehow far beyond the world? And there was this wonderful guy, small, impish-looking guy, who was a photographer. Everywhere we went, he was there. Many of my photographs of Korea are photographs of the photographer taking pictures of us in Korea. At the end, he came as we were leaving and gave us a stack of big format prints, giant stack of prints of many of the pictures. The only thing that I didn't like about it is that since every talk was filmed, I couldn't repeat the same talk over and over again. It would have been a lot easier, right? Everywhere I went, I had to talk something different, you know? So it made it a lot harder. But we had a lot of fun, and I knew nothing about Korea, and I learned a lot. I read a lot of things and talked to a lot of people, and really became so impressed with the passionate, sad, difficult history of Korea right up to the present moment. And we met many, many Sunim, men and women, wonderful people, beautiful people. So we made a lot of new friends. And my greatest thrill was I got to spend a half a day with Ko Eun, who is the great national poet of Korea. He's like, Ko Eun is like Emily Dickinson, Walt Whitman, and Allen Ginsberg, all rolled into one. And he really is probably the greatest poet in the history of the nation. Because he lived through, the 20th century is possibly the most colorful, tragic, and defining time in all of Korean history. And Ko Eun has lived through that history, very involved in politics and social issues, and for 10 years or more, a monastic in the Chogye order, deeply steeped in Buddhism. And he was the disciple of the great 20th century Korean master. So it was a great trip. So I've just given you a little report so you know what I've been up to. I didn't just drop here from the sky. I dropped here from Korea. And then in Upaya, we had really had fun, right? We had 21 days of practice. About 30 or 35 of us there for the whole time. About half of them were young people who are residents of Upaya. And every weekend during this 21 days, we had special events. So people would come for a study weekend or a Zazen Kai. And then at the end, we had a session, and a lot of more people came for that. I know Ewan is just back from Tassajara, practice period, 90-day practice period. And it's really fun. If you ever have a chance to do a practice period where you're for several weeks in residence, and Susan too, right? That's right. A very eventful, catastrophic practice period at Tassajara. If you ever have a chance to do something like this, it's a great thing. It's not a retreat exactly. It's more like regular life, except there's zazen in the morning and in the noon and in the evening and at night. The rest of the time, though, you're just living among other people, and that's what makes it interesting and, of course, very difficult. Retreats are easy because you don't have to talk. But once you talk to people, then anything can happen, as you know. So we had fun. And Santa Fe is a really nice town, high up in the mountains. And it snowed. April, you know, it snowed. It was beautiful, beautiful snow on all the trees and bushes. And we met a lot of new people, and there were some old friends there, and lots of new people, so we made a lot of new friends. So it's good to go traveling around. If someone invites me, I feel like, good, let's share our practice as widely as we can, because actually the world needs practice, spiritual practice now, more than ever. Authentic spiritual practice, it doesn't matter if it's Buddhism or Zen Buddhism, but authentic spiritual practice that is not just ideological, that engages the whole heart and mind and soul. Boy, do we need this now in our world. So I should go whenever I can and share our practice, and you should too. You should share your practice with your friends. Not pushing anything on anybody or bothering anybody, but just being willing to share your heart. We need this. So then we came back from all that, and then we went up to Bellingham, where we were last weekend. And in Bellingham we had ceremonies, and I stepped down as the guiding teacher of the Red Cedar Zen Sangha up there in a very sad and quiet and sort of pathetic little ceremony. Oh, it was so sad, you know. Nobody came, you know, nobody went. The old guy, who cares about him, you know, nobody came. It was very sad. Goodbyes and endings are sad, aren't they? But endings are exactly beginnings, right? So after that sad, pathetic ceremony, the next day we had a joyous, wonderful ceremony. A lot of people came from all over. It was really, really quite exciting. And Tim Burnett, as I stepped down, he stepped up, and he's the new guiding teacher of the Bellingham Red Cedar Sangha, succeeding me. And here we are in Vancouver, about to do exactly the same thing. This evening, at the end of the evening, I will have a pathetic, sad, depressing ceremony that probably all of you will be go home and not even come to it, you know, because why go to the ceremony? We could go home a little earlier and, you know, watch TV or something. And then the next day, we will have, after the retreat is over, I think at 2 o'clock on Sunday, a joyous, upbeat, wonderful ceremony when we'll celebrate Michael and Kate succeeding me as the guiding teachers of this sangha. And you know, I don't like to bother people. I know everybody's busy, you know, everybody has so many things to do. Life is so complicated now. I don't like to bother people. And I never say, oh, you must come to this ceremony. But the ceremonies are really important. You know, after they're over, I realize, oh, this is really important, these ceremonies. They mark a moment in the history of a community. And they're very moving, key moments. So, I'm fading away. You can see, if you kind of cross your eyes a little bit, you can actually see me literally fading away right in front of your eyes. Gradually fading away. However, I hope that even as I'm fading away, I'll still be able to come and visit you, and that in the blink of an eye, it'll be 1 year or 2 years or 3 years from now, and I'll be sitting here talking to you just like I am now, as if no time had passed, providing the guiding teachers will invite me. I will come, providing my body is still able to drag itself onto an airplane and off, and my brain still works. I will be here, I hope, because I think that some Zen teachers actually retire. I've heard this. But I can't really quite imagine how, when you don't work to begin with, you could retire. When the only thing that you ever do is go around visiting your friends, how do you retire from this? You know, it's like saying, I retire from being your cousin. No, you don't retire from being somebody's cousin or brother or sister. This continues until life ends. So I have no plans to retire. So now I'm finally getting around to the point of what I'd like to talk about today that I was talking about in the Dharma seminar at home and also was talking about at Upaya. And I want to share these teachings with you. The Yogacara teachings from Vasubandhu's 30 verses. This is a great text, a classic Buddhist text of the Yogacara school. It's a style, you know, Buddhism, an ancient style, to write a short poem, an elegant, usually four-line stanza, some formal literary form, very, very shorthand notes almost for a much longer and broader teaching. So this text of Vasubandhu is quite short. It's really just 30, I think, four-line verses in Sanskrit, just a few pages long. But it includes the most profound teachings of the Yogacara school, which is one of the most important teachings that stands behind Zen. So I've been trying to understand this text for many, many decades, but I've never really, since it's so pithy, you know, and it requires a lot of commentary, and I've never really been able to penetrate it. But now there is a terrific new book that finally makes this text really clear and understandable for practitioners. And this book is called Inside Vasubandhu's Yogacara, A Practitioner's Guide, and it's by Ben Connolly, who's a wonderful young, although to me now everybody's young, but I don't know how young he is, but he seems young, priest at the Minnesota Zen Meditation Center in Minneapolis. Wonderful person, a very, very good priest and student of Buddhism. And I am really amazed and impressed by Ben's book. And I have been, now I'm second time through reading it, and each time I find more in it. It's an amazing feat, really, that Ben has accomplished. You don't necessarily understand what a feat it is until you have been studying this text for many years and realizing how hard it is to understand. And then to see someone make it relatively lucid and easy to understand is kind of an amazing feat. It really is. Ben doesn't know Sanskrit, but he worked with a Sanskritist named Wei Zhentong, and together they made a new translation that I think clarifies a lot in the text and takes into account the translation that they made was not a philosophical or a scholarly translation, but a translation that takes into account the practitioner and what we as practitioners need to get from this text. People often refer to Yogacara teaching as Buddhist idealism because the school apparently is saying, just like Bishop Berkeley in Western philosophy, that the world doesn't actually exist. There's no world out there. It's all in our heads. Seems to be saying that, but this is not really what the Yogacara teaching is saying at all. What it is saying is that the world as we know it, the world as we experience it, the world as we live it, is in fact an event in consciousness. And so it's very important that we understand and situate ourselves properly within the event of consciousness. Because if we situate ourselves within consciousness in an inaccurate way, we're suffering a lot. And this is always the point of all Buddhist teaching. Buddhist teaching does not propose to tell us what's happening in the world and what's really going on. It only proposes to tell us a story about what's happening in the world for the purpose of reducing our suffering. So it's really, really important for us, Yogacara is saying, that we understand our own minds and how our minds work and how our minds produce suffering and how our minds can produce happiness. So this might sound a little bit abstract, but in his commentary to the text, Ben makes it really clear how important this is for our living. The other important thing about the Yogacara teaching and why I think it was formed, and you see this very clearly in Vasubandhu's texts, is that Yogacara combines two different but related practices. On the one hand, the practice of working with mind and emotions. And on the other hand, cutting through our excessive concern with mind and emotions. So in a way, these two practices seem like the opposite of one another, but they're quite related. So this is a very tricky point. Buddhism, I think, we really appreciate in our contemporary world because it's really good at working with mind and emotions. And as we all know, we really have to know how to be skillful with working with our own minds and our own emotions. But maybe you've noticed this in your own practice. If you get too interested in your mind and your emotions, you get hooked and tangled up, right? The very effort to understand yourself becomes a kind of self-reflective confusion. And you forget all about the Heart Sutra that says all dharmas are empty. There is no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no awakening, no ignorance. Vasubandhu's 30 verses puts these two teachings that seem opposite together in a seamless text divided into two parts, dealing with both these two great teachings, which deal with our two great human problems, our afflictive emotions that cause us so much trouble, not only in our own minds, but between each other, right? This whole world is the product of endless afflictive emotion. Why are there wars? Why are there conflicts? Why is there racism and sexism in this world? Because of our afflictive emotions. So it deals with that problem, but then it deals with also the deeper problem of our deeper delusion and misknowledge that produces the afflictive emotions to begin with. So Vasubandhu, just to give you a moment of background, was a 4th century Indian Buddhist sage. And as you know, Buddhism had a brilliant efflorescence in India, but disappeared from India quite more than 1,000 years ago, I think, something like that. So Vasubandhu was some 600 or 700 years after the time of the Buddha, at a time when Buddhism was probably at its height and at its most beautiful point in India. And he was perhaps the greatest sage of that period. And there are many colorful stories about him that I wish I had time to tell you. He wrote a huge number of great works. Huge number. Some scholars will list these works. It's unbelievable, the amount of stuff. All kinds of works on all kinds of subjects. He is the author of the Abhidharma Kosha, a 4-volume encyclopedia of Buddhism that has been the classical Buddhist encyclopedia for more than 1,000 years and still is read for its excellent explanations of everything in all of Buddhism. And he's claimed as an ancestor by many schools of Buddhism, including ours. We chant his name in our lineage, Vasubandhu Dayosho, as you would have chanted almost every day at Tassajara, right? Vasubandhu Dayosho. So I'm going to today just say something about the first of the 30 verses. This is the first of the 30 verses in Ben's and Weijian Tung's translation. Everything conceived as self or other occurs in the transformation of consciousness. That's the first verse. I realize that that doesn't sound like much. You know, like, what? Okay, fine. Now what? But actually, when you think about what he's saying there, it's quite something. It's actually staggering. So he says, self or other, which means self, on the one hand, which I think we all know what that means, and everything else, on the other hand. And when he says conceived, everything conceived as self or other, he means that this dichotomy between self on the one hand and everything else on the other hand, everything else in this case meaning like other people, the entire world, all objects of perception, all thoughts, all concepts, all physical matter, everything in that's not me. This distinction between self and other that we take for it's obvious to us, right? He says, actually, it's a metaphor. It's not a fact. Which means that the life that we totally take for granted, that we think we're experiencing, is not the life we're in fact living. We are conceiving of a world and a self that doesn't exist in the way we conceive of it. That's what he's saying. There's a huge gap, in other words, a chasm, a yawning chasm, right in the middle of every one of our intimate experiences. This giant gap between what's going on and what we conceive of as going on is a painful, painful gap that is the cause of all of our suffering. So let's take a little deeper look at this basic dichotomy, self and world, or self and other. Other is Ben's way of translating, and it's a really good way of translating, because other indicates, you know, otherness, the other, right? We say the other, otherness, alienation. What is not me is foreign, strange, possibly threatening, separate, distant, probably not trustworthy. And isn't this exactly how we live? It's amazing to me. I mean, I marvel at this. How could we live like this? We actually live. I mean, this is absurd, but we really live this way. To us, there are only two things that exist in this world, right? Only two things exist. One is me, and the other is everything else, right? It's a crazy thing. But this is actually, we get up in the morning, and this is our world. Me, and everybody else, and everything else. And of course, the part that we really care about is me. That's the part. That's the part that really matters, right? That's the part that I'm thinking about all the time. That's the filter through which everything we observe and experience passes. The entire world and everything in the world, all the people, all the things, the wind, the breeze, the trees, everything in this world exists in relation to me, right? It's like that character in Catch-22, which maybe people younger don't know this novel, but it's a famous novel, World War II, Catch-22. There's a character in this novel, I think it's Yossarian, his name is. There's only two things that happen. Everything that happens is either a black eye or a feather in my cap. Everything that happens is either good for me or bad for me. It's the only thing that matters is it good for me or bad for me? Everything really is perceived in relation to ourselves. Everything either works for me or it doesn't work for me. That's how we talk now. We say, this works for me. This doesn't work for me. And since the world is very big, very full, and quite various, and we ourselves are very small and vulnerable, actually, there are a lot of things that don't work for me. A lot more things that don't work for me than that do, right? How in the world am I ever going to be safe and happy when poor little me is facing this giant, scary, impossible, unknown situation that I will never be able to get out of and that I have no ability to control? I mean, we're all trying to cope, right? We even hope a little Buddhism will help. But let's be honest, this whole battle, we're going to lose, right? There's no hope. Even if you make good purchases, eat well, and get plenty of exercise, and have a good therapist, it's still basically a losing battle. And when we live this way, fundamentally, there's no way we can appreciate the world the way it really is. Because we are literally seeing, as Vasubandhu is going to detail here, we are literally seeing with our eyes and our ears, we're experiencing with our very sense organs a distorted world filtered through our confusion and our fear. And as if that weren't bad enough, we also have to have bodies, right? We can't live in this world without bodies. And as long as we have bodies, what does this mean? Basically, it means we're going to get sick. And if we're lucky, old. And whether we're lucky or not, we're going to die. And you know what? That doesn't work for me. It doesn't. So in other words, we're living in a truly horrifying and impossible losing situation. This is really bad. It could hardly be worse. It's intolerable. No wonder that Buddha began his teaching. Did you ever think about this? Buddha becomes awakening, and the first thing he says is, all conditioned existence has the nature of suffering. That's the message that the Buddha brings back to us. That's why he says this. So this verse of Vasubandhu's is telling us that this really awful situation that we take completely for granted and that we by and large fail to notice because denial is so attractive and so fundamental to ourselves, that this situation, which is the basis of our entire personality, our entire way of living, our way of perceiving, our way of deciding, our way of feeling, this whole situation is not anything more than a metaphor. It's not the fact that we take it to be. It's a poetic metaphor, a form of speech, a form of communication. When we misunderstand this metaphor, we will make a terrible, terrible world. But when we understand it, when we live out of that understanding, we can make use of this metaphor. We can make beautiful poems with this metaphor. So in other words, we do not need to get rid of it. We can't get rid of it. But we can understand it with our whole body, and our whole heart. And then we can take delight in it and make use of it. And that is why we are practicing. So that little by little, through the process of our ongoing practice together, we will come to understand who and how we are. And we will be able to engage our lives in a different way. So what is this metaphor expressing? What it's expressing is the flow of life, the ever-changing, ever-connected, loving flow of life. And life means life and death, right? This is a key part of the faulty structure of our thinking. We think that there's life, and then there's this other thing called death that doesn't work for us. We like life. We don't like death. We would just as soon forget about it, keep it at bay. But this is not true. Life is death. Death is life. Heart Sutra says, there is no sickness, old age, and death. Of course that's true. That's actually true. And that's what Vasubandhu means with his phrase, the transformation of consciousness. That means that life flows on and on and on and on. It flows from body to body. Bodies flow in and out of one another. Lives mix and merge and swirl round and round. One life transforms into another life in this timeless realm that we metaphorize as past, present, and future. Time itself is life and death as one continuous flow. How does a moment arise? Of course, how does a moment arise unless a moment passes away to make room for that moment to arise? This is how we live, life and death in each moment. Time is flow, and flow is life and death flowing on and on together. There is only the dance. There are no dancers. There is no me, there is no world. There is no life, there is no death. Me and world and life and death are metaphors I need in order to participate in this great dance. I need, this is the thing we don't understand, we need our human problems. We need our human confusion in exactly the same way that a flower needs the sun. So all of my clutching and worrying and fearing and defending, all of my loneliness and despair and separation and confusion is music. So I can let go and join the world that is myself. Nothing can hurt me. Nothing can harm me. Even when bad things happen to my body, as of course they will. Even when my emotions get wrung out with all my fussing and fuming, which might happen from time to time when conditions in my life produce that state of mind. Even then, nothing can harm me, and everything is okay. The dance goes on. Life is life. It's literally a wonder. Literally wonderful. Because I never know what's going on, I never know where I am. And I don't have to know what's going on. I don't need to know where I am or why in this vast, vast cosmic world. Who knows anything? But all these questions are entirely beside the point. We don't need to know, as we say all the time in Zen, our favorite Zen story, not knowing is most intimate. We dance. We swim. We participate. Flowing along with this endless, endless river of life and death. Whatever we feel, whatever life brings to us, even when we don't like it, even when it doesn't work for us, it's okay. It's beautiful, and we know that. We feel it deep in our heart. Our practice brings that feeling to us. The 83rd case in the Book of Serenity. Sorry. Guishan asks Dawu, "So where did you go today?" And Dawu says, "I was at the doctor." Guishan said, "You must have seen a lot of sick people there." Yeah. And Dawu said, "There are the sick and the not sick." And Guishan said, "So, well, surely you must be one of the not sick." And Dawu said, "Being sick and not sick has nothing to do with it. Speak, speak." And Guishan says, "Speaking has nothing to do with it." So the question of this story, and maybe the question of our lives, maybe this is the human question, right? Who is sick? Are we sick? Or what is sickness? Is anybody sick? Is anybody not sick? We are human beings. We all want to be well, right? Nobody wants to be sick. But being a human being is literally having a terminal illness. I always joke with my doctor friends, you should write on the death certificate, cause of death, life. Because all other causes of death are just incidental, right? We all have a terminal illness, so we're all sick. Everybody's sick, but also we are all perfectly well into eternity. Because being sick and being well are simply metaphors. They're temporary, illusory, metaphorical positions in space. Little eddies in the stream. So Dawu says, being sick or being well has nothing to do with it. The it here is Tathagata, suchness, isness, thusness, things as they really are-ness. Being sick or being well have nothing to do with this deeper onrushing truth. Our real life is beyond all the things we're concerned about. It expresses itself in all the things we're concerned about, and it's beyond all the things we're concerned about. Speak, speak, then, Dawu says to his Dharma brother or teacher, Guishan. And he says, speak, speak. You often, in Zen stories, somebody says, speak, speak, you know. Because we have to talk. We have to speak. We have to express ourselves. Each one has this task to express ourselves in the middle of this impossible, vast, completely baffling and amazing situation that we cutely refer to as our lives. As living beings, We have the responsibility, and we have no choice but to express ourselves, each one uniquely. So he says to Guishan, speak, speak. And of course, Guishan does speak. He says, speaking also has nothing to do with it. In other words, I can speak, I will speak, I must speak, but I will never explain myself, because that can't be done. My life is too vast. So, here I am today, having traveled in two continents, giving innumerable speeches, speaking many thousands and tens and hundreds of thousands of words that are in the air, vibrating as sound waves striking your eardrums, registering in your brains, echoing through all the thoughts and ideas and feelings of a whole lifetime. And all this has nothing to do with it. It's kind of great, you know, it takes the pressure off. Nothing to do with it. And yet, this is our human life, right? This is our life together. Expressing ourselves with words, with gestures, and as in these few days, with beautiful silence. This is how we are human together. There are not that many of us, you know, just a few. Think about it. There's just like a few little human beings, just a few, in this giant cosmic universe. What a beautiful thing to be together, right? To express ourselves side by side together, walking hand in hand on this immense, unknowable journey. We are going somewhere. We are getting there together. So I'm really blessed to be able to be here together with all of you. Again, I hope I'll be with you another time, maybe tomorrow even, if we're all lucky enough and the world still exists and we're still alive. This is what we do. So thank you very, very much, all of you, for, I think I said this last night, for already understanding. Otherwise you're not here, right? Already understanding the importance of doing this together. Thank you for having that profound understanding that has brought you here. So, onward with our retreat. Thank you.
May all treasure be extended to every being.